I woke up with this feeling I didn't know how to deal with, and so I just decided to myself I'd hide it to myself and never talk about it, and did not go and shout it when you walked into the room. I think I love you.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, August 21st, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning, we have Michael Bortantier and Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com, also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesday, and also writes for the Newark Star Ledger. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Bortantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You could see his writing and photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could see some of his other photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. He also writes for NPR. And also you can see Peter and Michael's books at Amazon and various other bookstores around the world and nation.
Where they still exist.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Maybe, are your books in Dress Circle in London? We have to check that out. We know that so much drama has happened around Dress Circle in the last last couple of months. All righty. So let's start off with news here. The Muni, a big, huge, honking outdoor theater in St. Louis, just wrapped up its 93rd season, and its executive director, Paul Blake, is leaving. And there's a new team coming in. So I just wanted to, you know, see what you guys thought. I mean, the Muni seems to be at least an actor's favorite and audience favorite to go out and play the Muni. It's a fun place. St. Louis is a great theater town. There's a little changing of the guard here at the Muni. So, Peter, have you been out to the St. Louis to see any shows?
Oh, yeah, certainly. The Muni is quite an experience because I think it has 11,000 seats, and many of them are quite filled when every time I've been there. What's also nice is that some seats way, 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 way in the back are free. And even if you can't get in there, a lot of people come and they sit on the lawn behind the theater because the sound system allows you to hear everything. And many of the shows that are done are shows that people are very familiar with. For example, I've seen Sound of Music and Camelot there. That proves that point. So so it's quite an experience, and it's very nice that this still exists. I had no idea it was 93 years. That's really impressive. How wonderful to see that people still come out for it, that it's a real tradition there. So Paul Blake has kept it alive, you know, so more power to him. And he's also done a few shows that have been jukebox musicals, quasi originals. I know he did a Breakfast at Tiffany's with Henry Mancini music. I think he's done a Roman Holiday with other people's music. So he's tried that type of show there, and I think it's gone over there, even though many of these haven't had much of a life. I believe White Christmas had its roots there. I could be wrong about that. But nevertheless, we have to give credit to Paul Blake for keeping it alive. As I understand it, the shows at the Muni aren't as ornate as they used to be way back when, but that's no surprise. But the fact that it has survived, it's one of the few theaters of this type in this country that has continued to make a go of it. So so credit to Paul Blake. He is looking to the future for the Muni. I hope it continues. You're right, James. St. Louis is a very exciting theater town. I love going there to see two other companies, in fact, while we're on the subject. And one is Stages, a company that does more recent musicals. They've just finished Secret Garden. They're about to do Victor Victoria. They've done shows that aren't necessarily bonanzas, such as Big, I saw there, which was a wonderful production. Really terrific. David Schmidt played the lead. He was tremendous. I also saw him do The Drowsy Chaperone. Tremendous. And then there's New Line Theater, which is Scott Miller's group, which likes to call itself, this is not my term for it, this is his term for it, the bad boy of St. Louis Theater, because he likes to do the off-Broadway shows, such as Bat Boy. Although he does do Broadway shows as well. I saw an Evita there that was terrific. As well as a 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. But he also did The Nervous Set, a 1959 musical that ran 12 performances on Broadway, 23, something like that. So it's quite a town to go to. And I haven't even talked about The Rep, which is their Blue Chip Regional Theater, which I've only been to a couple of times, but I did see Mr. Roberts there. Now, what's wonderful about Mr. Roberts is it has a million people in the cast, and they did it anyway. So, yes, my hat's off to St. Louis. I love going there, and oh, do I love standing by that beautiful arch by the river. So we'll see what's up for Paul Blake and the Muni, but good luck to it.
Yeah, one of the things that excites me about the Muni is that it's a great way to... It scales. You can go and get your very expensive tickets, as you mentioned, all the way up front, and then all the way in the back, you can get in for free. And it's a great way to introduce families to the Broadway experience. And you know, 93 years, obviously, they're doing something right.
I'd like to interview somebody, in fact, who started way back in the back and worked his way up slowly but surely. I think that would be an interesting story to talk about the memories, you know, that when he first saw The Desert Song, which he probably did, he was essentially like watching trained fleas, you know, from that back row. But little by little, got to the next level of price and the next level of price and what those prices were. So if anybody's out there who has a history of the Muni, I'd love to talk to you and do a story on your memories. Obviously, I'm not going to get anybody who's had 93 years of experience, but I'd love to talk to anybody who's had a good deal of experience working his way up from back row to front.
That sounds like a really interesting thing.
Could be.
Yeah, St. Louis. It's a great college town. I don't know if it's a great college town. It's a great musical town.
There are some nice colleges there. You know, Webster is a very accomplished college, and I understand they do have a good theater department too. So,
and they have the St. Louis Cardinals, which
yes, indeed,
has a connection to Broadway.
Yes, are you talking Rocco Landsman specifically, or
well, I could be talking Rocco.
All right, fine. In a reasonably new stadium, by the way, which is right next door to the stadium they used to have, which at least last time I was in St. Louis was a parking lot. They tore down a perfectly good stadium to build another one right next door. I can't say I know why. I've been in both those stadia, and I certainly saw no need to build a new one, but what can I say?
Well, some of you might know that Rocco Landsman was the president of Eugene Jamson and left to become the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, where he is right now in Washington, D.C. And it is rumored that after he's finished with the National Endowment of the Arts, that he will buy the Cardinals, giving it a Broadway connection. So we'll see what happens there.
He tried to buy the Cincinnati Reds a few years ago, yeah. In fact. You know, so I think the reason that Rocco loves the Cardinals has to do with the fact that the most famous St. Louis Cardinal of them all was a man named Stan Musial, Musial. There's even a statue of Stan Musial in front of the stadium. Now, do you notice that the word Musial appears in the word musical? I mean, it's just with a C added. So I think that must be part of the appeal that links Broadway and baseball there.
Yeah, I think that's his hometown as well. I'm not sure.
It is, in fact.
All righty.
And in fact, ironically enough, his relatives, Jay Landsman and Fran Landsman, wrote that aforementioned The Nervous Set that Scott Miller did. So when Rocco... what's the word I'm looking for? dedicated the Walter Kerr Theater on opening night. He mentioned, in fact, that he had such great respect for Walter Kerr and what a great critic he was and so on and so forth. And the only mistake he ever made was panning the Nervous Set, you know, that his relatives had written. So it started there in St. Louis. And in those days, shows didn't start like that. This was just a little production out of town, and it made its way to Broadway. Now, of course, that's the way it happens. But in those days, you know, you went to Philly, Boston, and Baltimore in a conventional tryout. So in a way, Nervous Set was ahead of its time.
All right, making our way a little bit north and a little bit east. The Shaw Festival. Richard Azunian, our good friend over at the Star in Toronto, wrote an article on the Shaw losing its top billing at the Shaw Festival, but there's a little bit more to it than that. So, Michael, why don't you tell us a little about that?
Oh, yes. Well, I didn't know until you mentioned it that apparently he remarked that next year there will be no Shaw plays in the largest venue of the three that they have. And but I've only been there once to the festival, and I loved it. But as I remember, the largest theater is a very new theater, you know, I want to say state-of-the-art, whereas the other two are smaller but much more charming in older buildings. One of them looks like something from the turn of the 20th century. And so it strikes me that that they are better for Shaw in terms of just the whole milieu and everything. So I don't know how much of an issue that really is. It may sound like one, but I'm not sure that it is. I remember seeing Mac and Mabel in the very large theater when I went, and it seemed like it was good for that kind of a show, or, you know, a really big play or a musical. And Shaw didn't write any musicals, although he did his works inspired at least two that I can think of that people might have heard of. So I'm not sure if this is much of an issue, really.
I guess it would be for big shows like Man and Superman. And I guess if they were doing Man and Superman, they'd put it in there for that matter. For shows like Mrs. Warren Profession, it's not going to hurt to put it at the other two, which are called the Courthouse and the Royal George, which are off-Broadway-sized theaters. And the other one is not quite a Broadway-sized theater, but... which is called the Festival Theater, by the way, and it Michael's right, it's the newest, and it is good for musicals, where I just saw My Fair Lady, in fact, which, as Michael alluded, has a Shaw connection. What was the other one you were thinking of, Michael, the other Shaw?
Isn't it The Chocolate Soldier?
Right, there is. Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was that one you were mentioning. Oh, there was a 1968 musical version of Caesar and Cleopatra called Her First Roman.
Oh, right. Yes.
So I wasn't sure which one you were mentioning. But yes, The Chocolate Soldier, which is Arms and the Man.
Isn't that Vernon Duke?
No. Irvin Drake.
Irvin Drake.
Right, very close. Right, there is an analogy. I never noticed the similarity between their names. So Irvin Drake, who wrote that famous Frank Sinatra song when I was 17, it was a very good year.
Right.
And also wrote the Broadway musical What Makes Sammy Run, which ran. So anyway, I was just curious which one you were alluding to.
Yeah.
All righty. So...
breaking news, by the way, if I may jump in. According to someone online here who is quoting Danny Burstein, who plays Buddy in Follies, there will be a new cast album.
Oh.
A 2-CD new cast album on, let's see, let me find it here.
It's PS Classics.
Yes. Okay, you knew that.
Yeah. I remember back in the 70s when studio cast albums of shows from way back when were coming out, and I thought, in the years to come, what will be the album that gets recorded more and more that will get studio cast albums or other cast albums, and it didn't take me more than a second and a half to say, oh, that's going to be Follies. So so I'm looking here. How many Follies recordings do I have here? All right. There's Sondheim's demo. There's the original. There's the concert. There's a recording somebody made me from when everybody was on Merv Griffin. there's a complete in-theater taping of some production. I don't know which one it is. There's the paper mill. There's the one that was done in Michigan. There's the London one. Yep, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 Follies I have now. So this will take me into double digits, I guess.
Well, those aren't all commercial recordings, in fairness.
To be fair, but still. And I'll bet that there are plenty who have other recordings that aren't remotely these. So, how many commercial ones have there been? I mean, you know.
Four, isn't it? The original London, the concert, and Paper Mill, and now this will be the fifth.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, so that's pretty good, to say the least. I'm sure there are people who are going to say, oh, we don't need another Follies, you know, but the people who do need another Follies are the ones who see this one, and they want that experience.
I think it'll lower many people's blood pressure if they play it in front of the theater rather than the original cast.
Well, altogether, though, when you think of it, people just want to have a recording of the experience they had that night. Certainly, there's been a lot of talk about how cast albums should really be made at the very performance the people attend. Rock concerts do this, that you can buy exactly what you heard that night, including every whoop of applause that you gave at the end of the show. That's been known to happen. And people who work these concessions often tell me that you've heard this too, Michael. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, you go ahead.
Your turn to talk.
Well, that they get many requests for that. And also, people can't. I did some work in a theater memorabilia shop near in the theater district, and I can't tell you how many people would ask and would not really understand why they could not get a recording of a show if they saw it with a replacement cast.
Mm-hmm.
We've discussed this quite frequently over the past few weeks in the sense of new models for cast albums and also new ways to think of them, thinking of the recordings as marketing tools rather than just making money from the recordings themselves. All of these things factor into it, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised. I mean, as we all know, the pace of change on Broadway for some reason is quite glacial compared to many other things, but maybe we will get to the point. I would not be a bit surprised if we get to the point where, just what you said, Peter, where they will record every performance and make it available to the audience immediately afterwards. It shouldn't be that difficult to make some kind of blanket agreement with Equity and the other unions, because again, it would be money that they don't have already. I mean, if people are just not too greedy about it, and if they're realistic about exactly how much money they're going to get, or even if they get a very small amount, again, just the benefits it gives in terms of marketing the show and keeping it alive in people's homes and. Those are tremendous benefits. So it's such an interesting subject, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and every now and then I love to take a recording that is not the original and play it just to see a variation on a theme. One example out of many, I like when Roger Bart on the revival cast album of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown goes high at the end of Not Bad at All. One example out of dozens that I enjoy hearing. So there are variations on a theme, and if you know an album inside out and love a score to death, it's fun to have other people give their takes on it, and it makes a little different and interesting listening experience, a more fascinating one. So I am all for any new recording of any show, but mostly for the people who are going now. This will be somebody's first Follies. This will be someone's favorite Follies. It will, you know. And as a result, I'm glad that that person, those people, will have this recording available to them.
I'm surprised but delighted that they are going to do this one. But I guess they, you know, bravo to everyone. I think maybe they're not looking just only at the bottom line and saying, well, you know, even if this is not tremendously successful in terms of sales, it's great in terms of marketing and in terms of just public relations, if that's the right word. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, as far as the marketing, it'll be interesting to see how quickly they can get it out, because Follies does have quite a limited run. But
sure. Yeah. Another factor is we're going to hear it with the full orchestra, so that's wonderful as well.
Yeah, you know, that thing you just said about alternate casts, Peter, it's so true. And especially if you, as you say, if you have one album in your head, mm-hmm. and then you hear another one, especially after a long time. It wasn't until about 6 months ago that I finally got, someone gave me a copy of the Sweet Charity with Juliet Prowse.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to hear, you know, because it's basically the same orchestrations as the original with Gwen Verdon, but obviously the cast is different, and just, you know, the differences in the tempos and approach and things like that. I used to, when I was younger, I used to make a point of seeking out foreign cast recordings, mm-hmm. And some of them were really wonderful. I for some reason I got out of the habit of that, and I'm not sure how many of them are available on CD. But that's another really interesting thing.
I will say that the Irma LaDuce in Hebrew gives you a headache. that D-Donk will drive you crazy. But nevertheless, I also have to point out that the London cast recording of The Most Happy Fella, which is severely truncated, of course, it's not only just the songs, but heavily edited. But the thing about it is I like the recording technique better. This is subjective, of course, but I like when people are very close to the microphone.
I believe that's in stereo and the original is not.
Right, that too. Yeah. Oh, it is a dynamic recording, that London. It's now available again on Sepia, the label that London does. When things fall into the public domain after 50 years, they can be released at no cost. Not no cost, but you know what I mean. Mm. At far reduced cost, and as a result, a lot of these things are coming out on CD 50 years later. And really, I highly recommend, for those who love The Most Happy Fella, to get a listen to this London cast album, which is a very exciting and spirited recording. So, go ahead.
I'm going to order it right now.
I don't think you'd be disappointed. I really don't. So that's another alternate situation, because the recording technique is different.
Right.
So that's another variation on a theme that we get with these other albums.
All righty. So you guys touched upon it, but I just wanted to share with you that when I was first started collecting cast recordings, whichever one I got first was really the ultimate recording.
Oh, of course.
And when I heard something that in the end, you know, others deemed the best recording you can have, I was like, oh, I can't stand it, you know. And I mean, it are both of you sitting down?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, mm-hmm. good, because, you know, this experience yep. for me was about the pop version of concept recording of Starlight Express versus the London recording of Starlight Express. And that can be painful for many people. So
on all levels.
On all levels. On three levels for Starlight Express.
it was by experience with Finian's Rainbow. The first one I got was the 1960 recording, and it was years before I heard the original cast album from 1947, And I didn't like it at all. Now, that's heresy to many people, because Ella Logan, who gave one of the great Broadway debuts, or so we're told, is on that original 47 album. And I find her mannered, and I much prefer Jeannie Carson on the 1960 recording. And I just got so used to it. Frankly, every now and then, when I play Kiss Me, Kate, I play the 1961, I think it is, stereo recording that was made with the original cast, or at least virtually everybody, if not everybody. They brought it back because now there was stereo. There was no stereo back in the late 40s when Kiss Me, Kate first came out. So as a result, they brought everybody back together to get this new, exciting innovation. And that's the one I know best. And as a result, when I get nostalgic for Kiss Me, Kate, that's the one I play because it reminds me of when I was a kid hearing it. So that's an important consideration. Speaking of stereo, I got to tell you this. Sony Masterworks Broadway is releasing a children's musical called Half Past Wednesday, which is a musical version of Rumpelstiltskin. So as a result, there is a song that Rumpelstiltskin has about that he has a dual nature. He only has half a heart because he's the product of one human and one non-human. So he talks about the fact that sometimes he's good, sometimes he's bad. And there are lyrics to that effect. But what's so interesting, because stereo was a big deal then, when he says sometimes I'm good, he comes out of the right speaker. And when he says sometimes I'm bad, it comes out of the left speaker. So it's really fascinating how they use stereo in those days. RCA used to love to have the sound go from one speaker to the other. You could travel it across, like when people were walking across the stage in Coffee Break and How to Succeed, they used to go from one speaker to the other, that type of thing. So, but it was so funny when I was listening to this Half Past Wednesday this week that I heard that coming out of the speakers, and I thought that was really very funny. That was a creative use of stereo to indicate duality.
I could go on for hours on the subject of stereo and cast albums. This is a favorite topic of Gerard Alessandrini and myself. But
is it really?
Give
us your best shot.
Well, there's one really, really interesting story, and it sounds right. They basically, 1956, the fall of 1956, as far as we can tell, is basically when they started to make cast albums in stereo. And at that point, a lot of them were made by Columbia, the vast majority. But there were some transitional ones. So if something opened in the spring of 1956, like My Fair Lady, it unfortunately was in mono. It just missed it by like 6 months or less. And then, of course, they wound up doing it in London, but I don't like that recording. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I don't either.
Apparently, one of the first ones was Candide. It was so new that it was almost like they were like recording it experimentally in stereo. And it was not initially released that way. And then it became a cult recording very quickly, to the point where a few years later somebody said, you know, hey, we should go back and record Candide in stereo and get all those people back. And some engineer said, you know, I think we did. And they were all ready to go back to drag everybody back into the studio, and it turned out that they had it recorded in beautiful stereo that sounds, if you put it on today, it sounds almost like a modern recording. That's great. I mean, I think it, I mean, obviously stereo to me is preferable to mono anyway, but especially in a theatrical property. I mean, it does add to the theatricality of it, and the even if they don't do things like having some people come out
right.
the left and the right, it just adds a feeling of depth and more of a feeling of actually being there. The other thing is that, which is so wonderful, is that because of the way stereo works, and I won't get into the technical aspects because I don't fully understand them myself. But if you play a stereo recording, say made in 1959, back on a surround sound system, you will get actually from the rear speakers, you won't get voices coming from there, but you will get the ambiance of the recording studio or whatever venue it was. So that makes it even sound even more like you're present at a show. It's really fantastic. If you've if some of you have never listened to a stereo cast album or any other album through a surround system, if you put it on the right setting, you can get some really kind of very amazing results. So try that out.
So what I learned, I'm sorry. Go ahead, James.
No. Peter, what were you going to say?
Well, I learned after writing an article about stereo, something I hadn't known before. I have this book. I call it a book, maybe a little aggrandizing, but it's something that somebody typed and put together. It's stapled as opposed to having a perfect binding. And but it gave the when every cast album came out, what the date was, and when it was cut out of the catalog. So I pointed out that the stereo albums came out in 1956, 57, 58, whatever they were. And so many people wrote me and said, no, that's not quite true. The mono albums came out then.
Yeah.
But in those days, in the early days of stereo, the stereo albums came out some months later. It took longer to do the stereo recordings, which I had never known. You did, Michael, huh?
I don't think you it was... I don't think it was that it took longer. I think it's just that the market was initially, and then as more and more people got the stereo playback equipment, they released them. All of those Rodgers and Hammerstein soundtracks, which are so fantastic, Oklahoma, Carousel and the King and I, Carousel. I believe those all came out first in mono. And, the Annie Get Your Gun, the Lincoln Center version with Ethel Merman. If that wasn't the first one you heard, it's so far superior to the original in terms of, first of all, the amount of was recorded, the faithfulness to the original arrangements and singers, and also the sound quality. It's just there's no way there's no comparison.
And you also don't have to listen to Who Do You Love, I Hope, and you do get to listen to Old Fashioned Wedding. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that either. You know, that hits the spot as well.
Michael, I'm going to ask you a loaded question now.
All right.
So, knowing that you've had your old Porgy and Bess recording for many years, when the new recording comes out, which will be your favorite?
You think they'll record it?
Well, you know, there's that Audra McDonald and Norm Lewis factor in there that might sell a few recordings. Audra is going out on a concert tour. I'm imagining after the art production of Porgy and Bess and before the Broadway production, but there seems to be a little controversy, Michael, isn't there?
Well, apparently it's not after the art production. It overlaps with some of it. And, you know, it's funny. I was just talking about this the other night with the general subject with Stephanie Umo, who played Sarah in the most recent revival of Ragtime, and brilliantly, I might say. And it was kind of a general discussion of what a vocal what roles are too difficult for people to sing them 8 times a week, and also how much of a workload is considered to be onerous for a singer. There are so many variables in terms of the individual person and their voice, the amount of singing in a show, the type of the range of the role, whether it's you need to sing in different registers, also how much dialogue there is. But it came up because it came up because in the original production of Ragtime, I believe, Audra missed quite a lot of performances. And then when she did Marie Christine, she actually had an alternate. And she has gone on record as saying, quite frankly, that she, you know, if there's ever a question of any chance that she might damage her voice, she'll just call out. But I was thinking about that because, first of all, Bess, certainly in the original version of Porgy and Bess, would be the kind of role that someone would probably not normally be expected to sing 8 times a week. And Porgy certainly not. But I don't believe that Audra or Norm have alternates for the ART production. If anyone knows otherwise, please tell me.
I haven't heard that either.
But maybe because of the changes that have been made to the score and the cuts, maybe Audra doesn't feel she needs an alternate. But also, you know, it seems like almost like going from one extreme to the other. She's going to be singing one of the greatest, most difficult roles in American musical theater, and then she's immediately doing a concert tour to overlap part of that, and then supposedly coming right to Broadway in Porgy and Bess also. So I'm just a little surprised, given the way that she has expressed her feelings about vocal conservation in the past. I just wanted to make that point. I'm not sure exactly what the deal is there.
All righty. So, you know, seeing Audra in concert is a great thing. I hope that it works out for everybody involved.
Mm-hmm.
Bess is also one that just parenthetically. Bess, I would say, I mean, the amount of singing is not tremendous, certainly not compared to Porgy, but it is another one of those roles where normally, if you do it right, it's supposed to be sung in the lower range in a sort of almost a musical theater-y belty, if I hesitate to use the term, but that's kind of what a lot of it is written at in a more conversational, poppy way. Most of it is legit opera. So going between those two things, that's the kind of thing that can really wear on a voice. I was reminded of, I mentioned Aldonza in Man of La Mancha is another example of that. And actually every other role that Joan Diener ever did, I think, La Lume in Kiss Me Kate.
Kismet, you mean.
La Lume in Kismet, yes, I'm sorry. And she was famous for that. Judy Kay was also famous for being someone who can do the belting and then like soar up into the soprano register. And she certainly kept her voice, but it's generally considered difficult, very wearing on a voice to have to do that. So I don't know. We'll see. You know, if Porgy is still coming to Broadway, I saw the marquee up the other day. So for that's worth. So I don't think it's been canceled or anything because of the controversy. But in terms of the vocal longevity of the performers, and if they do have alternates, but I highly doubt that's going to happen.
Boy, that's a subject for us. How many marquees were up for shows that didn't come in? The Baker's Wife marquee was up, I know, and Busker Alley painted the whole outside of the theater and the show didn't come in. Anyway, I'm not wishing Porgy and Bess bad luck, of course, but anyway, there's still a lot to go between putting a marquee up and the show actually showing up. I do think it's coming. I'm just being facetious.
Yeah, yeah. Funny story. I was thinking of trying to go see it at ART, but they didn't. I could only go on a weekend, and the ticket availability wasn't good. A friend of mine said he called right after the Sondheim brouhaha, and it was on hold for a really long time. And then when he finally got on, they told him that there were limited tickets, and he bought one. But he said, "I guess you guys are pretty busy there, huh? Getting a lot of phone calls." And she said, "Yes." She said, "Stephen Sondheim is the best thing that ever happened to us."
I'm sure. I'm sure.
You know.
Just like when an evangelist, you know, condemns something, suddenly people have to go see it. So,
right.
yeah, really, it's funny. In a sense, Sondheim is likened to the Christian right in helping to promote sales of a controversial work.
Yeah,
so, funny thing.
On the American Repertory Theater website, we'll link to it in the show notes. They got a Porgy and Bess page, and in the Porgy and Bess page, they have everything listed here, and they have a section called Non-Required Reading, which is basically various news and feature articles from around the internet. But suspiciously missing from this is a link to Mr. Sondheim's opinion in the New York Times.
Right.
All righty. Speaking of leading ladies and concerts and great Broadway stars,
I know where this is going.
Judy Garland is coming to Broadway again in the End of the Rainbow. Not quite Judy Garland, but her story. And Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I can't tell you much because I don't know a lot about it, but I will say that it turns out this show has already been recorded because it played in London. And so you can sample the recording on Amazon. And I do have to say that just from a vocal similarity standpoint, that it was really very disappointing to me. I can think of five other people, some of them actually women,
imagine
who sound much more like Judy Garland in terms of inflection and quality of the voice. One that leaps to mind is Isabel Keating, who did it in The Boy from Oz.
And marvelously.
Yes, really very well. And she's only one. So I have read that that this is not intended to be an impersonation. People always say that, you know, and I guess it's true. But I don't know. In this case, it would seem to me that it would be probably better if it was someone who sounded more like her.
On the other hand, Michael, perhaps... And I'm only saying perhaps. I don't know. I don't know the show at all. But can it be that the point is that because this is one of her, if not the last concert, that she's in terrible voice, and that's part of the point of what's going on here, that this is the end of the rainbow? Maybe that's it. If so, it's going to be a lousy cast album, I'll grant you. But nevertheless, maybe that's the point of it, that it ain't the Judy of old.
No, but actually, I'm glad you brought that up, Peter, because the reason it's not good, in my opinion, is that it sounds too pristine and far too young. But I'm not sure. I think I believe the songs in this are presented as sort of in almost like flashback or not occurring in real time.
I see.
I'm sorry, I haven't read as much about it as I should have. But isn't it supposed to be like an interview that's happening at the very end of her life, so I think the songs are supposed to be not in real time, so that would take care of that little issue.
Also happening this week is that the Los Angeles Department of Cultural Affairs is soliciting community input for a proposed Broadway Arts Center. Isn't that great that LA is building an arts center dedicated to Broadway? I think that should happen everywhere. What do you guys think about this? Have you seen great shows in LA? Crickets? Anyone? Well, maybe that's why we need a cultural center in LA. I mean, you know, the Hollywood has got a pretty good imprint there.
The only thing that, and I don't know any of the details of this, but I mean, they do have the Mark Taper Forum and that whole complex there. So it's not as if they don't have one.
No, absolutely. But isn't the Mark Taper really more or less, a touring production place? It's not really a producing theater, is it?
I don't know. The one thing I saw in that space was a wonderful... wonderful production of Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde. And it was fantastic. And it wasn't a tour. But that's the... And what's the larger space there, Peter?
Is it the Amundsen?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Amundsen. That I believe isn't almost 100% a touring house.
I would think so.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen Les Mis there. But... Gee, good. You know, build it. Wonderful. It's so amazing to me how much little theater goes on, non-equity waiver theater goes on in Los Angeles. It's never hard to find something there. And wouldn't it be nice if one of those groups steps up to the next level and gets a bigger and cleaner and nicer space than something on Melrose Avenue. So, we have to remember that once upon a time, the Roundabout was this little dinky organization off Broadway, one of a million little companies, and it rose. You know, inevitably, somebody will do something right and be able to rise and become a major player. Roundabout had it happen to them. So maybe there's some small theater in Los Angeles that's really waiting for the next stage, and this arts center will build a nice 300, 500-seat house that will house them terrifically. That would be of major interest to me, that a little company steps up. That would be fabulous.
Well, that's a great point, because my own limited experience of theater in LA is that there's no middle.
Right.
There's like the shows that are the equivalent of basically off Broadway productions,
mm-hmm.
and then there are the huge touring shows.
Yeah.
Very little in the middle. And that, what you're saying is absolutely true. That would, if that might help greatly in that specific way, to give a kind of a middle of the road venue to theater artists out there.
What's the Encores equivalent out there at the Hollywood Bowl?
Reprise. Yeah. Jason Alexander's highly involved.
That's not the Hollywood Bowl, James.
It's not Hollywood Bowl.
That's a separate thing where they've been doing one every summer, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Reprise, I'm not sure where they are now. I think they've moved a few.
But it just reinforces that point. Either they're very, very big or very, very small. There's no...
Right.
It doesn't seem to be a middle of the road type of thing that could be out there. You know me; I'm one to come up with these nutty ideas. You know,
you sound like Mrs. Lovett.
You know me.
Well, you know, you know, I've talked about in the past about let's totally close Times Square to traffic and create a Broadway Walk of Fame. But something else that I've thought about is that wouldn't it be nice to have a sort of YMCA type of thing for theaters all across the nation? And I was trying to, you know, figure out how this realistically how it could happen, and I came up with this idea that might kill people, but. Hear me out.
Okay.
Hear me out here.
Mrs. Lovett.
Do you think that Walmart could save theater?
Wow.
You're going to have to explain, because I've heard YMCA and now I've heard Walmart and I'm thoroughly confused.
Okay. There are 2,933 Walmart supercenters across the nation, and most of them are open 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
They have an average of 185,000 square feet and employ about 350 employees. So if Walmart made a public-private partnership to create community centers in Walmarts, and not actually in the store, but in a square box connected with the store. They have the parking, they have the facilities, most of them are open 24/7, and it would give an infrastructure to build a theater community nationwide.
The only problem is, of course, the product that Walmart would want in its theaters.
Well, no, I'm saying that this is the type of thing that wouldn't be managed by Walmart, but that's the public-private partnership. You know, it's like, you know, we go from town to town, and the YMCAs can be in towns adjoining to each other, great and terrible all at once.
All right, but this season, it was a lot of affection and respect for the motherfucker with a hat. It was considered a really good play, and I have a feeling it wouldn't be playing at a Walmart theater.
No, absolutely, and I would hope that they wouldn't be called Walmart Theater or Walmart would control any content in and out of it, I would bet
they'd want to.
Yeah. Well,
also,
you know,
I mean, you know, we're certainly not going to get into it, but it goes without saying that the company is tremendously controversial in terms of the way it pays its workers and the way it gives or doesn't give health insurance and lots of other things. So
absolutely,
I don't know if that's such a good idea.
Well, you know, I think that maybe rather than Walmart changing theater, maybe theater can change Walmart.
Oh, that would be nice.
And, you know, there are other options out there. I mean, it's a discussion I've had a couple days ago from a business standpoint about Walmart versus Target. I mean, Target and Walmart prices are very similar, yet Target pays their employees better and has health insurance and doesn't lock their employees in their stores overnight and things like that.
Yes. So,
I'll make them spell out the word Walmart and do the twist when they do the squiggle in between Wall and Mark. Do you know about that?
No.
That's a real exercise that goes on there.
Before
they start a shift, they get everybody together to spell out Walmart with their hands and legs. So it's
Well, I think Tommy Tune could fix that and make it artistic. All righty. Going from the brave to the sublime.
Right.
Barbra Streisand and the Gypsy film has peeked its head up again in a USA Today article where Barbara was interviewed and says that the plans are still intact.
What a shame she didn't get around to this years ago.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. But I will say, has anyone seen Captain America?
No.
I haven't. Yeah.
It has special effects, of course, because it's an action movie. But the most amazing thing is that for the whole first half hour or so of the movie, they take Chris Evans's head and put it on the body of some very scrawny guy. That when you then see the transformation into Chris Evans, you go, oh my God. But anyway, this is so well done that you would never, ever, ever believe that it wasn't an actual whole person. I mean, I can't describe to you how seamless it is. And I thought, well, God, if they could do that, they could, you know, if it's allowed, they could certainly do whatever needs to be done digitally to Barbra Streisand's face or neck to make her look 40. Mm-hmm. But you know that, of course, this opens up a tremendous can of worms in terms of,
doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, let's have Lansbury do the main movie again.
Sure,
you know.
Well, you know, we could all get behind that.
I could. I absolutely laughed when I read the USA Today thing, because part of the article is that Streisand was asked about, Streisand is also asked for her thoughts on Lauren Ambrose, the actress chosen to take on the challenging role of Fanny Bryce in the revival of Funny Girl, which Streisand originated on Broadway in 1964. Are you ready? She says she was unfamiliar with the former 6 Feet Under star, so she watched a video of Ambrose singing My Man, one of Bryce's signature songs. Quote, but it was up-tempo, so I couldn't judge it, she says. Mm. Quote, it doesn't matter because she doesn't sing it in the show, unquote. And I thought, like, well, couldn't you just say, you know, I wish her well? it was up tempo, so I couldn't judge it.
Well, we'll see when it opens on Broadway if Barbara attends.
What an event that would be, huh? I dare say she will not. I don't think she's going to want to be in the middle of 1,000+ people. So I right in the middle of an audience, I think she would feel far too vulnerable.
There was a thread on all that chat on Talking Broadway the other day about somebody rich, famous, and powerful attended some show, and there was Secret Service there, and they disrupted the whole show. And all I could think of was that would be nothing compared to Barbra Streisand's entourage.
sure. In fact, that would be the way to do it, that she would have to buy out the theater and have her entourage there so she could see the show. So that would be the only way that I think she'd attend. So,
speaking of my man, by the way, do either of you, have you heard or do you suspect, is there any discussion of putting that into the show and or I'd rather be blue and maybe possibly Secondhand Rose? Because it's such a unique situation. It really, when Funny Girl opened on Broadway originally, those were the days when Fanny Brice was still a name that meant a lot to a lot of people. But then, obviously, as time went on, less so. And it became Barbra Streisand, and Funny Girl became all that most people knew about Fanny Brice. And when the show was on Broadway, it was it had a score by Julie Stein and Bob Merrill, and it was a point was made not to include any of Fanny Brice's actual songs that were written by other people, and it because that just was not something that was done in those days. Then when the movie was made, I believe over severe objections from Julie Stein, they put in three songs that were made famous by Fanny Brice: My Man, I'd Rather Be Blue, and a little bit of Secondhand Rose. So now I think, as we all know now, nowadays it's all about branding and marketing and familiarity. So if they don't put in My Man, especially, I think there is going to be a lot of disappointment from a lot of people, which is not saying that I think they should put it in, but I'm just remarking on how, I mean, it's an incredibly famous moment in the film that everyone associates with Funny Girl, and most people probably don't even have any idea that it was written by someone else and wasn't in the show. So I wonder if they are even considering that.
I do too, and I go back and forth on what the right decision will be in terms of using the music that makes me dance, the My Man song in that place. In a way, it would seem to be wise, because therefore she wouldn't have to go up against Streisand in at least one song, because most people know My Man as opposed to the music that makes me dance. It might make the music that makes me dance a nice rediscovery, because it is a terrific song.
So beautiful.
It really is. And though what's fascinating to me is if you look at the sheet music of the music that makes me dance, it's all quarter notes. Not all, of course, but and Streisand didn't sing it that way. It really is. I know he's around. She really made it a much more interesting song than it is, at least on the page of the original sheet music. It's possible that it was subsequently revised, but when that sheet music came out in 64, believe me, it was quarter notes. And but I do think it would be a great idea, and it would make the show, quote unquote, new, to have what happened then. But I certainly know that productions of Grease, people come up afterwards and say, hey, how come you didn't use, you know, the movie songs? So many people who have ushered have told me that when they ushered Maury Esten and Arthur Coppett Phantom, that people would rush up at the end of the show and say, how come you didn't sing Music of the Night? You know, because they didn't know it wasn't from that Phantom, and they thought they were seeing that Phantom. So for the average theater goer, I do think there's a good chance that he or she is going to be expecting exactly the score that one heard in that 1968 movie. So it's going to be certainly interesting to read what the decision will be.
The thing is, it's if one wants to, it would be quite easy just to stick in My Man, because what you could do is keep the Music That Makes Me Dance and Who Are You Now, which is another beautiful song. Fanny sings like six songs in the last half hour of the show. But then the very end of the show, as written, is a reprise of Don't Rain on My Parade. And I actually did, years ago, a community theater production of Funny Girl, and they stupidly or ignorantly thought they could just put in My Man. And so they put it in right at the end instead of the reprise of Don't Rain on My Parade. But I don't know if some disgruntled auditionee or someone, whoever, called Music Theater International or whatever.
Yeah, it's a TAMS show, I think.
Oh, TAMS. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, anyway.
They got a cease and desist letter. And they had to immediately take it out. I'll never forget one night, the night that happened, the woman playing Fanny had to sing and the orchestra had to play the reprise of Don't Rain on My Parade cold, never having rehearsed it once.
Wow.
So that was an interesting performance.
I'll say.
Maybe it was Stephen Sondheim really, that reported them.
That's right. Yeah, TAMS really rained on their parade, no question about it. Someday it's going to come out, by the way. The Gershwins went to Steve Sondheim and said, Steve, will you write a letter complaining about this so that we can get box office receipts, earn the money? Anything is, I believe everything and I believe nothing, as both Oscar Wilde and Inspector Clouseau said. So,
by the way, Julie Stein, for the record, he has said, and of course he's biased, but he said he thought that putting in My Man at the end was a tremendous mistake, mainly because if you do it that way, then the last thing you see of this woman is she's singing, she's ripping her guts out over this guy who has just left her, rather than moving on and
you know
showing that she's, you know, this incredibly young and talented and ambitious, positive young woman, which is what Don't Rain on My Parade reprise does. So that's a point to consider when we find out what they do with this revival.
All right. So we're going to go from one great singer proven to a possible great singer. Michael Riedel has reported that Bobby Cannavale has been now working on singing with Sutton Foster. And it's possibly that he might end up in Nice Work If You Can Get It. What do we think? It'd be great to have Bobby Cannavale in another show, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, as Nikki Arnstein in Funny Girl, he'd be very good.
Someone suggested, isn't that a great idea, Peter?
It is, because he doesn't have to sing much.
Yes, and also that, and also he's so charming.
Yeah.
But convincingly, you know, as someone who's charming but like really flawed, you know, we've seen him do that already.
Sure.
That kind of character. He was great in Bells Are Ringing with your girlfriend, James, at Encores.
Oh, well.
I didn't know you had a girlfriend, James.
Happily
married.
Well, you know.
I'm just referring to James's great admiration for Kelly O'Hara. Yeah.
Yes, I know.
But yes.
I would say her name, but it's in the court order that I'm not allowed to speak her name. I am going up to Caramore on September 24th to go see her, so. We'll see.
A pretty place.
Yeah. Oh, Caramore's a great place. Yeah, talk about a great artist community.
Sure.
All righty. So, who got out to the Fringe this week?
I saw the Barty Bunch.
The Barty Bunch. You know, that fight between the two television families. Peter, tell us about that.
This is a very clever show. It doesn't ostensibly makes sense why it's happening, but nevertheless, this is the Brady Bunch, family up against the Partridge family, but with much Shakespearean language. And why anybody's speaking Shakespeare, I don't know. Frankly, what I think should happen is that Shakespeare goes to the Starkeeper and says, listen, you let Billy Bigelow go to Earth one day and have his wish. I understand the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family have been canceled. I think there's still life in those series, and I'd like to go down and save them. I think they need some sprucing up. And if that happened, you know, then I'd understand why indeed there is a situation where everybody's speaking Shakespeare. However, whether or not these families should be speaking in Shakespearean terms, and the writer is astonishingly clever in the way that he uses some famous Shakespearean quotations, such as to be or not to be, or something rotten in Denmark, in the state of Denmark. They're very, very, very clever ways of using them. He just doesn't throw them in. I mean, he really has a real, well, to quote Shakespeare, method, if this is madness, there's method in it. So so that's fascinating to see. However, what's really interesting to me about this property is the fact that it reminds us that this is the last gasp of innocence in America. Now, true, the Kennedy assassination had already happened in 63 and so many other assassinations in 68, but there was still a type of innocence that was left in the Brady Bunch and the Partridge family. I dare say that after Watergate, that was one of the last straws. We had never had a president resign. And coincidentally, that's around the time that these shows had had their day, that it's very hard to put on a show on TV now where there's a family that has those same sunny and everything will be solved situations. And so the irony of that is played very well in the Barty Bunch, because when there are murders, genuine murders, yeah, you know, it's you hear lines like, "Your mother and I do not like what happened." You know, that type of, and it really reiterates the fact that in the Brady Bunch and the Partridge family, all problems were solvable. Nothing was over the top. That that everything could be solved. And it reiterates the fact how innocent these shows were. That's what's the skill of what this guy has done. That a tall glass of milk, you know, solves things. Or after some atrocity that you can't believe that you just saw. And it's a pretty bloody show. "I hope you kids have learned a lesson from all this." You know, those lines, you know. And occasionally he plays with them. "I am fortune's chump." You know, which I thought was pretty good, too. You know, I also give credit to this writer whose name is Stephen Garvey, as opposed to the ball player Steve Garvey. I also give him credit, and please don't take this the wrong way, but he didn't go for the easy thing of making one of the characters gay. You know, that we all knew that somebody in that family seemed to be gay. That he doesn't go for that at all, which would be such an easy way to go. And I give him credit for resisting that. All right, there is a suggestion to something like that when one kid wears a bit of drag, but nevertheless, he really, it sounds like a junky property, but I'm telling you, he really aimed high in what he was doing. And you could tell he knew Shakespeare well, and he knew the TV shows well as well. So as a result, my hat's off to Stephen Garvey for doing a very nice job here.
Michael, did you see Barty?
Yes, Peter and I saw it the same performance just last night, wasn't it?
It was Friday, I believe. But so, Michael, we can't say if we disagree on something about a performance, we can't say the usual.
What show did you see?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, what the performance I saw. It's off the night you saw.
Actually, I don't think we disagree. I think we both really enjoyed it. I was a little trepidatious because it sounded like it might be the kind of thing that would be funny for 5 minutes and then not. But it's so well done. I thought maybe it was like only like maybe like 10 minutes too long. There was a point about two-thirds of the way through where it seemed like it was treading water a little bit. But other than that, it was so much fun. I mean, just to see, like, for example, the relationship between Marcia and Jan Brady reconfigured in Shakespearean terms, you know, and with Carol Brady as sort of doing Lady Macbeth-like things. It was great. And I will say I certainly watched both the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family. I'm not so familiar with the musical oeuvre of the Brady Bunch, but the Partridge Family I had and have, again, on CD, all of those albums. So it was so much fun to actually hear the songs in the context of this show. That one of the running jokes is that they keep delaying the singing of "I Think I Love You," which is a kind of notoriously famous Partridge Family song, and then it finally comes in at the end, and the audience just loves it. But it's so clever. I maybe if I could read the program note just to give people an idea of exactly what's going on here. It says, the Brady and Partridge families are an assemblage of tragic figures. Two lovely ladies and one man, each widowed at an uncommonly early age. Their 11 children, each stripped of a parent, most before reaching teenage years. Though smiling on the outside, all 14 individuals are haunted by loss. But for a brief period in the early 70s, there was a joyous respite, sunshine days when all of life's woes were resolved within 30 minutes, with occasional 90-minute solutions during picturesque family vacations. This is not our story. We joined the families just after the ABC network ceased airing the chronicles of the Bradys and the Partridges. It was a summer when America found itself deciding the fate of an unlovable president and recovering from an unwinnable war. And it was a summer when these beloved TV families, no longer under America's watchful eye, met on a collision course in a blood-soaked, vengeance-fueled, lust-filled, very special episode of Shakespearean proportions. So, really just tremendously clever. The way they I want to clarify, it's not a lot of actual Shakespearean dialogue. There is some a lot of it is parodies of Shakespearean dialogue, which makes it so funny. The parody of Something is Rotten in the State of Denmark is so funny, I can't tell you, and I'm certainly not going to give it away. I hope that everyone gets to see this. This was the first show I've seen in the Fringe, and I have to say it really set the bar very high. I was very, very pleasantly surprised, and I think it deserves to be supported.
I do have two more observations on it, though. One is the fact that I thought that Mr. Garvey had painted himself into a corner, because what I noticed during that period of time, Michael, that you're talking about where it dipped, and was the fact I started thinking, you know, maybe the audience has more affection for the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family than they're letting on. And maybe the reason it's dipping is because they really don't want to see these people killed and killed so brutally. But I'm telling you, he gets himself out of that situation very, very nicely. So I thought that was good. The thing, though, that is going to be a barrier for this show being done again, of course, is, you know, you have the Brady Bunch, you have the Partridge Family, you have a lot of people on stage. You know,
that's this a lot.
It really is. That's the flaw, you know, that and I wonder if he can reconfigure it to have, you know, like one girl play all the Brady girls and one girl play all that. You know where I'm going with this. But anyway, but it's going to take a ton of money to produce this. There's a lot of salaries involved here. And that will be a barrier to its getting done again. I'm sure he knows that. And this is not news. But nevertheless, it does reiterate the fact that, God forbid, this may be the only time that this is done. And as a result, the time to see it is now.
By the way, Peter, I spoke with Stephen Garvey afterwards, and I told him that I was very lucky quite recently to have interviewed both Florence Henderson and Shirley Jones. So I told him I would mail them. I took two extra copies of the program, and I told him I would mail them to him. And he was like, "Oh my God, that'd be so great." It would be fun to have one of them there. I'm not sure which of any of those people live in New York. Does Danny Bonaduce live here?
I don't know. LA.
Yeah,
because he's got that television. He had a television series.
Speaking of Danny Bonaduce, the fact is that there were not all the time, but some characters had good resemblances to their TV counterparts. So it was pretty, especially for a Fringe production, you know, where a lot of people are not available for work because, of course, the pay is low and non-existent. So I thought that some of them bore more than a passing resemblance to the people we have known and loved for a long time.
Oh, and they had a great wig for the guy playing the David Cassidy role.
Yes.
And for some of the others, presumably the one we just mentioned, the Danny Bonaduce guy was terrific. And I don't think that's probably his real hair. It was so well done. I was so happy, you know, because the Fringe, of course, like all theater, it can be very variable. But even more so because things are put together quickly and, you know, lots of different variables. But this one, it's a big thumbs up for me, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, it is a hoot, yes, but it's on a higher plane, and so...
It is on a higher plane. And also, what you alluded to before, Peter, it had one of those wonderful things where the whole show is basically presented as a very comic, over-the-top spoof, but there was a moment towards the end where was the equivalent of the tomb scene in Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. And it suddenly, you kind of felt people suddenly like... reacting to it, really moved by what was happening. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's so great when that happens. I've only seen that a few times before. Gerard Alessandrini has his musical version of Madame X that's going to be in the Nymph coming up. And I saw a reading of it some time ago. And that was, again, pretty much the same thing. I mean, you're laughing. It's so campy. You know, it's over the top. It's you're laughing at the characters to a large degree. Mm-hmm. But then at the end, you damn if it doesn't just kind of suck you into it. You know?
Yeah, that is rare. Yeah, yeah. There's a musical version of Moby Dick that wants to be a spoof, and then it wants us to take it seriously, and it can't make us do it. So when they can make us do it, that's really something.
Well, I thought that was, and I know we disagree on this, so we won't get into it, but I thought that was one of the best things about Brief Encounter on Broadway, because mm-hmm. I thought that they achieved that too, that there was a lot of very over-the-top stuff, staging and and acting, and you know, but then contrasted with moments where you're really responding to this 60-year-old weepy, you know.
Yeah, and to be fair, most people agree with you than me on this property. So
yeah, but the point is still the same, you know, whether or not.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to tell you that I agree with you. All righty. To wrap it up, before we actually wrap it up, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio section. Right below that logo, there is a subscribe button. That way, each and every time there's a new episode of Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes. If you choose to listen to This Week on Broadway in other ways, maybe on your Zune or in your Android device, you can do that as well through various different things, the Zune Marketplace and in Google's Listen Android application. Or you can listen to us through Stitcher, STITCHER, which is an application for your BlackBerry, Android, iPhone, whatever. And you can listen to it there. If you're in front of your computer, you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And if, in fact, you are somebody who has been around for 93 years or less and has been to the Muni and wants to get in touch with Peter, you can find Peter's contact information as well as Michael and mine and various other places. People on BroadwayRadio.com. So you can go there and check that out. Peter did see one other show at the Fringe, Sammy Gets Mugged. So, Peter, why don't you give us an overview on that?
Sammy Gets Mugged is exactly what it talks about, the title says. It's about a young man who's a writer who's living in Paris, who's hoping for the best for his life and career, and then he gets mugged in the hallway of the apartment building in which he lives. And he brings up the very good point that that's one of the worst places that can happen, because it's obviously a place that you pass every day, and you are reminded of what happened to you. So the play is about coming to terms with your having to deal with a tragedy like this. Are you going to make it the tragedy of your life? Are you going to think about it endlessly? Are you going to obsess about it? Or are you going to move on? I guess one of the things that should come up in the play that doesn't quite is that moving on literally, meaning moving to a new apartment, which is a very good solution, may not be economically viable to this guy. Maybe the playwright just felt we'd infer that and he didn't have to bring that up. But what happens is that he replays the incident endlessly. He deals with the man who victimized him, putting him in different situations, and he just cannot shake what's going on until about 65 minutes later, when he finally realizes the only way I'm going to get over this is to get over this. So in a way, it's an obvious and simplistic message, but the fact that it's very well directed by Noah Himmelstein, a young director, makes it more urgent and really makes it pack far more of a wallop than it might if I had read it on the printed page. I really thought it played very, very, very well. And it really started making me think about if it happened to me in a way that I hadn't thought before. Because one thinks of muggings, you know, on the street, you know, that type of thing. But really, if it happens so close to home, literally and figuratively, how do you survive that? How could you not think about it day in, day out? And how does it not become the defining moment of at least your immediate life? So a lot of good writing, but I think really the menace that Noah Himmelstein brought to it helped it immeasurably.
All righty. So I guess that should wrap it up. Anything else that you want to mention for this week?
I'm looking forward to seeing Rent this evening. I'm getting to it a little bit late, but I'm really looking forward to that at New
World
Stage.
You're late with your rent.
Yeah.
Not the first time, right, Michael?
Oh, and just as a – yeah, yeah. Well, no, actually, yeah, it would be the first time. But
attaboy.
On Monday, we can maybe talk about this next week. I'm seeing another Fringe show, and this sounds really interesting. It's called Elysian Fields. Are you going to it, Peter?
I'm not sure I'm going to it, but I did talk to the playwright. I was intrigued enough to talk to the playwright, a young man named Chris Phillips, talking about his writing about three characters that we don't meet in Tennessee Williams' play. Alan Gray, who was Blanche's husband in Streetcar Named Desire.
Right.
Skipper, who is Brick's friend, or maybe more, in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And Sebastian Venable, who met a terrible fate in and it's talked about in Suddenly Last Summer. What's really nice is that Chris Phillips told me that when he was 9 years old, his father took him and his two siblings to a production, a community theater production of Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. Now, that's, in a way, that's great, and in a way, it's not, because a kid could so easily be turned off to theater because he doesn't understand the thing that's going on up there. Hmm. But here's what's interesting to me. Chris Phillips, when he was 16, was given an assignment by an English teacher. They all were, everybody in class. Okay, you got to go do a paper on a play and a playwright. Go to it. And he said, well, let me see what Cat in a Hot Tin Roof was about. Maybe I'll understand it now. And what he said, it was so significant to him because he was a young gay man and he knew it, and he was wrestling with it, and the play really helped him. And what's not very typical is he came out to his father first. In many families, the father is the last to know. But he had such a good relationship with his father that he went to his father and said, I'm gay. And the father said, you know, frankly, I've been waiting for you to tell me. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lovely story. And it's nice that Tennessee Williams, Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, helped this along. So so I hope to get to Elysian Fields. I have a very busy week this week, but nevertheless, I hope to get to it, because I think it's a wonderful idea for a show.
Yeah, it sounds great.
And so, you're going tomorrow, huh?
Yeah. So
you're going tomorrow.
Maybe we can talk about it when
And if I go tomorrow, we won't be able to argue. Well, at my performance, you know. So yes. So we'll see what happens.
It really sounds, I mean, because all three of those characters, there is so much discussion of them in the plays. Alan Gray a little less so, but still, it's, you know, it's a pivotal character. So what a great idea. I mean, just as an idea, I hope the execution is good, because
talk about a tall glass of milk. I mean, this is a tall order to fill. I mean, you are going up against Tennessee Williams, whether you like it or not. You know, so that's the real challenge that he has, and he really gave himself quite the challenge. But it has been done in Los Angeles, and I think it was well received there.
Yeah.
So we'll see if it's well received here.
All righty. So I guess that wraps it up. I just want to add one last point is that this Saturday, coming up, the August 27th, Robert Diamond, the owner and creator of Broadway World, is getting married.
Is he really?
So we have to wish him well and excitement. And I know that this week will be busy for him, at least, because
sure.
he's going to go see Rob Evener in concert on Tuesday night. All righty. So good luck to everybody out there. And we will see you all next week. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Have a great week.
Here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold, like their mother, the youngest one in curls. It's the story of a man named Brady who was busy with three boys of his own. They were four men living all together, yet they were all one day when the lady met this fellow, and they knew that it was much more than a hunt, that this group must somehow form a family. That's the way we all became the Brady Bunch, the Brady Bunch, the Brady Bunch. That's the way.